You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast produced by Veteran Strategies and featuring conversations with fascinating and impactful men and women who have shaped our world, our communities, and our history. My name is Robert Vane, principal of Veteran Strategies, and your host for our discussion. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, La Crown Plaza Hotel, Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. You can find all of your sales and rental equipment needs at McAllister.com. We are pleased to announce our podcast is a member of the All Indiana Podcast Network in partnership with Wish TV. You can find Leaders and Legends at AllIndianaPodcastNetwork.com. Thank you for joining us on the Leaders and Legends podcast. Our guests today are Lou Gehrig, PR. I don't even know what word I would use to describe how damn good Lou is at his job. Let's just say PR guru and super lawyer, Bill Morrow. They are from opposite parties, but they have a common heart and a common goal. And we're going to talk to them about their careers, and we're going to talk to them a little bit about this project. We're going to have some fun because, like all political podcasts, the Pontifex Maximus of political reporters in this state, in this market, has come out of retirement yet again, Mr. Jim Shella. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Great to be here, Robert. I don't know what you just said.
Pontifex Maximus, it was the head of the Roman religion back in, that's why the Pope is called Pontifex.
Yeah.
You didn't learn that at St. Cloud State?
I didn't teach us that at St. Cloud State. But thank you.
Lou, Bill, thank you for joining us. Thanks for letting Jim be a part of this conversation as well. Jim knows you two better than I do, has interviewed you, covered you, and the clients and candidates you worked for. So what I'm going to do is turn it over to Jim Shella and have him take you through it like the old days.
Well, we're here talking to Lou and Bill because you're working together now. One is a Democrat and one is a Republican. And maybe what we should do is, for the listener's sake, just establish your partisan credentials so they understand what this means. Let's start with you, Lou. I know probably the highlight of your career is the fact that you worked in the White House for Ronald Reagan, but tell us what else we should know.
Well, the highlight of my career was teaching 18 sixth graders English and history back when I first started. But I worked at Indiana Central, now UIND. That's where I met then Mayor Lugar, and then through that relationship, I met Mitch Daniels, and they offered me a job to go to Washington to be his press secretary, and I did that and got to work with a number of great people, including Mark Lubbers and Mitch and Teresa Lubbers, and just a number of great people. There on the Hill, I got to meet the press secretary for Senator Bill Roth, and that was Jim Brady, and he and I became real close friends. And when he went to the White House to be the press secretary, he said, you know, the White House can be a very interesting place. You need friends down here that need to cover your back. Now, I'm not sure that's true today, but it was back then. So that was, then I came back to Indianapolis, and then we started our PR firm 30-some years ago.
And just to make clear, you were the press secretary for Dick Lugar in the U.S. Senate.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. Bill Morrow, you've worked for a couple of significant politicians in Indiana history. I know Birch Bayh and his son, Evan Bayh. Fill us in on the rest of your background.
Well, I'm an Army brat, and I think that's relevant to my biography just in terms of the way I was raised to think about public service. Wasn't raised in Indiana, but met Birch Bayh in 1974 when he was running for re-election, and we just became enthralled with him and his ideals and values, and went off to freeze my fanny off in Iowa and New Hampshire in his presidential run, and then went to work for him in Washington. And yeah, I went to law school while I worked for him in Washington. And then when he was defeated in the 80 Reagan landslide, I was finishing up law school. Ann and I decided to move to Indianapolis to raise our family. And when Evan decided he wanted to go into the family business, this is an absolute true story. Birch Bayh made up a list of former staffers that Evan ought to reach out to. Ann Morrow was on that list. She'd worked for Birch for 10 years and had risen to a real position of seniority. And then as an afterthought, he said to Evan, yeah, you might want to call Bill. He might be of some use to you as well. But in terms of my,
for those, who may not know, Ann is your wife, right?
Yes, yes. wife of 40 years. Yeah, our marriage was the product of a secret office romance in Birch Bayh's office, and we were married in his hideaway office in the Senate with him as best man. So you can imagine how much we miss Birch Bayh. But just as a point of clarification, in terms of my partisan label, as a matter of Indiana law, I'm officially now a political independent because I stopped voting in party primaries because of the work that we're doing now. So I'm in a post-partisan phase of my life for the time being.
Well, for what it's worth, I've always considered myself independent, but that means that I can vote in either primary, which I have done. I know party leaders don't like that, but I personally think that nobody should let an opportunity to vote go by without taking advantage of it.
Jim, this is Robert Vane. May I ask you a quick question?
Absolutely.
I know we've had this discussion before about you switching and voting in some one party's primaries and another party's primaries. Was the motivation for you to vote for someone, or was it more often to vote against someone?
I would say more often to vote for someone. And you know, for what it's worth, you know, having been a political reporter for more than 30 years, I usually knew the people that were running. I knew them well. So mine were informed decisions.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Well, I think we should talk about, we've vaguely mentioned this project that you were working on, Bill and Lou. And I know, Bill, you were the initiator. Explain to us what the Indiana Citizen is and what you're trying to do.
Well, as Ann and I sat down to think about what life after the practice of law would look like, I retired from Barnes and Thornburg at the end of 2019. So in around 2018, we sat down and thought about what life was going to look like in 2020. And no, we didn't predict the pandemic, that's for sure. But it was a bucket of time for spoiling grandchildren. There was a bucket of time for, travel. And that still left some time for us to fulfill our civic obligations. And, you know, we really had a long talk about, how we could actually add some value. And it wasn't clear we were adding much value in the partisan space. And so the idea was hatched to set up a 501c3. It's called the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation. It's strictly and scrupulously nonpartisan. We have broad bipartisan support. It's evidenced by Lou's strong support. And so, that was the idea. We had followed the reports that have come out every 2 years called the Indiana Civic Health Index, where it shows Indiana kind of stuck in the bottom of states for wide range of civic metrics. And we thought, well, maybe this is a way that we can make a contribution. So that's how that idea came to be.
And Lou, how did you get involved?
Well, Bill and I had been, Bill came to me to discuss it, and I just felt that we need to have more people voting. And I think that what's been missing in politics in the last few years is coalitions coming, people from different parties coming together to try to solve a common problem. And so our firm and I got involved personally, and my son Tide is doing a lot of work with Bill. And so we're very pleased that Bill asked us, and we know it's an uphill battle, especially now with the virus that we're in, but it's worth the effort.
Yeah, and Lou's is always being kind of understated here. Lou and I have known each other for decades and decades and decades. I shouldn't add too many decades to that. You know, we have so many points of connection, common friends, that sort of thing. And I really went to Lou for a reality check. Right, given my partisan background, I wanted to talk to some high-profile Republicans that I trusted who would really tell me, just be very candid with me. Is this kind of a non-starter? Will this idea just be dismissed as a Trojan horse for Indiana Democrats? The first Republican I talked to was my dear friend and longtime law partner, Bob Grand. And he was the first to sign up. He expressed surprise, as many people, even active in the political process, do express surprise at our very low levels of civic participation in Indiana. And he immediately signed up. So Lou was my second stop. And he could not have been more generous. He said, Bill, how can we help Indiana? We ought to be able to do better than that. And everybody who's involved in politics and public life ought to be concerned about these low rankings and ready to do something about it.
Well, you spell out the low rankings, if you would. What is it that you're concerned about? What is it that you're trying to do in reaction to that?
Well, just a quick primer about the Indiana Civic Health Index. So this was the brainchild of the Indiana Bar Foundation. A big shout out to Chuck Dunlap and the Indiana Bar Foundation. And they, several years ago, enlisted the support of Randy Shepard and Lee Hamilton, still have been the two most prominent senior states people involved in this. And then Greg Zeller has come along in the last few years to be a big supporter as well. So this is a study that takes national data, data that the Census Bureau accumulates every 2 years. And it permits Indiana to compare ourselves to the other 49 states in the District of Columbia across a wide range of civic metrics. The two that always stood out to me are our low levels of registration and our abysmally low levels of turnout as compared to the other 49 states in the District of Columbia. And then there was a separate study done that was published in 2019 with 2018 data in which the Woodrow Wilson Center administered the citizenship exam to tens of thousands of Americans. And again, we finished in the bottom 10 of states for these basic civic literacy metrics. So another thing that we wanted to do as part of our cause was to try to create unbiased information about the candidates and issues. So it's registration, information, and turnout.
And you're trying, your ultimate goal is to increase voter turnout in Indiana, correct?
Correct. The metric that we care most about is turnout, right? I mean, first of all, if you work just on registration, that's a slippery slope just because of really how misleading some of the data can be. And when I talk about this, I know I get the backup of the Indiana Secretary of State and her team, and it's not intended to be. Heck, I was the Deputy Secretary of State when Evan Bayh was Secretary of State, so this is of no criticism to the current Secretary of State, but Indiana, as well as the rest of the country, our voter registration rolls are misleading due to death and mobility. So if you were to just look, go to the Secretary of State's website today and compare it as the numerator and compare it to the voting age population as the denominator, you'd conclude that some 94% of voting age Hoosiers are registered. So what's the big deal? Why work on registration? Well, we think the number is closer to 1.7 million Hoosiers in the voting age population who are not even registered. But registration, right, doesn't mean people are going to show up in November. We see that all the time. So, right, to your point, Jim, we really want to try to improve turnout substantially. We set the goal of 20% improvement in 2020. I was advised to try to set a moonshot goal. Well, at the moment, seems like maybe a Pluto shot goal. But all other things being equal, 20% improvement would move Indiana out of the bottom 10 to the top 10 of states. So yeah, registration is a critical metric.
Yeah, help me understand that, please. 20% above the 2018 turnout or 20% above the 2016 turnout?
2016.
And what was the turnout in 2016?
I'm glad you ask. I'm not going to trust my memory here, but it was 2,807,676. 2,807,676. So in round numbers, we're trying to improve turnout by another 600,000. We think, this is one of those moments in which rankings, since we're measured vis-a-vis the other other states, I always say all other things being equal, a 20% increase would get us out of the bottom 10 into the top 10 of states. And the reason I put that caveat in is because of what happened in 2018. In 2018, Indiana, we had a record turnout and we congratulated ourselves until the dust settled and realized that we only improved our ranking a couple of points. So we came in 43rd in 2018 because the rest of the country had a record turnout as well due to the way the president nationalized the 2018 midterms.
Just once again, help me understand, because you're talking about a 20-cent. You gave me raw numbers from 2016. What was the percentage of turnout in 2016?
58.3%.
And you're trying to get to 78%.
No. You just added 20 percentage points, right? Right. We're adding 20% onto the so that would get us into the mid 60s, right? Okay. You just added 20 points to 58.3.
Right.
You multiply 2,800,000 times 0.20, that number is about 560. And so that would be about a 20% increase.
All right. I just want to make sure everybody understands this. What is it Tim Russert always used to say? Explain it to me like I'm a sixth grader.
Well, no, it's a fair question. But I mean, look, we break into the top 10 by being in the high 60s. So there's a lot of compression, as you can imagine, but we're consistently at the bottom 10 of states by being in the high 50s. You got to be in the high 60s in order to be in the top 10 of states.
All right.
So which includes your home state. So,
which is Minnesota. And you and I have talked about this. I mean, one reason let me come back to this, because Minnesota has much different voting policy issues, and we need to discuss that. But I want to bring Lou back in at this point, because Lou, there is a general belief in the political world that high turnout benefits Democrats and hurts Republicans. So as a Republican, why do you want to be involved in this effort?
Well, I think the numbers are so low that we're just trying to get to not to the highest of high turnouts. We're just trying to move the needle some. And then I think it's fair game. I mean, it's always been fair game that whenever you have your candidates out there, it's up to the parties to get the vote out and to educate the voters.
You know, I've explained Bill's idea to some Republicans who are contemporaries of yours, and they talk about, you know, the legendary Republican politician Keith Bulin had a theory that what you want to do is identify your voters and turn them out. You don't want to target a general voter turnout, and it's a partisan effort. But obviously, you don't believe that.
Well, I think it has been in the past, but I think nowadays that fewer people are identifying with a party. And so it's up to us, whether you're Republican or Democrat, to try to get your message to as many people as you can. Bill and I have talked about this, that back when L. Keith Bulin was around, I mean, you had Republicans and you had Democrats, and they all knew who they were. But now you have a lot of split voting. You have people that may go from one primary to the next, depending on who's running. And so it's not like the days of L. Keith Bulin. And I think because of the outside interest groups that have spent a lot of money on these races and have a great deal of influence on who's going to win. So I think party structure, although still strong in Indiana, is not what I like it used to be. And I think all of us on this phone call, except for maybe Chris because of his age, we remember the days.
Okay. Let's jump back to the policies because Bill, you referenced high voter turnout in Minnesota. One reason for that is that they have same day registration at the polls. And they also have open primaries. They are the sort of policies that encourage participation and discourage control by the political parties. Indiana is very different. We have closed primaries. We have you have to register to vote 30 days in advance of an election. Why is it that you're not working on trying to change the policies to make voting more friendly?
Well, first of all, it's late September 2020 and the legislature's out of session. But really, from our beginnings, right as we first started talking about how we might make a difference and worried about the partisans retreating to their partisan corners, we made the affirmative conscious decision not to get involved in the policy discussion. And part of the reason that was really pretty practical. We didn't really step out of our silent phase onto the public stage until the publication of the latest Civic Health Index in November of 2019. There was a short session coming up. How many substantive changes were going to be made to the election law in the short 2020 session? Turns out zero. So it was really a conscious decision not to enter the policy debate quite yet. Well, we were drawn into the policy discussion really in the spring when the decision was made correctly, we thought, to move the primary a month and permit no excuse absentee voting in the primary. We were very involved advocating for that. I did any number of interviews, lavished the political leaders with praise for the wisdom of that decision. We are now, I think, a part of the policy discussion, and assuming our little nonprofit startup is even around after Election Day, I suspect we're going to play a role in the 2021 General Assembly session, trying to ask these questions, right? Okay, what's getting in the way of Indiana's voters being able to register and show up and vote? And there are some policy choices Indiana's made and some policy choices, as you point out, that other states have made. So let's have that discussion.
So having said all that, how are you going to increase turnout?
Prayer. not to be flip, but look, when we first started this in earnest, we were advised by really smart marketing people that if we were going to move the needle at all, this was a $3 million campaign, right? It's think of it as an advertising, marketing, communications campaign. We're not going to come anywhere close to that. We have hit gale force headwinds in 2020 as a result of pandemic, as a result of the opposition of the political class to what we're doing. So we're not going to raise anywhere close to that. I believe that turnout will improve over 2016. Hell, population growth should take care of that. But we're not going to come anywhere close to increasing turnout by 600,000. We're not going to come anywhere close. So will we have made a contribution? Well, I guess we'll sit down on November 4th, and that's a decision that's going to be made by, especially by our donors, as to whether we made a difference. I think we will have contributed something to the quality of discussion and informed voting by this information platform.
Okay. Well, Lou, I think your role in this is to help get the information out. Tell me how you're doing that.
Well, that's been one of the things that, we've gotten dealt with a number of social media, television interviews, radio, newspaper interviews, and I think the awareness factor has increased. Again, we want to translate it into numbers, and that's going to take some time. I mean, we are in unusual times right now, trying to make things up as we go, but the awareness, I think, has increased. Bill's been recognized throughout the state as being an expert on this issue. So we've been able to do that, and not with $3 million. So
we're going to see TV ads?
Only if they are aired as PSAs, and some of those are running, Jim. Yeah. So, right, we had hoped to be able to have the resources to pay to put those on. Our ad agency Element 3 produced some great radio spots, TV spot, billboards, and we are doing some paid social media, not anywhere near at the level that we had hoped. But yeah, you may see our TV ad if you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning, some morning. But actually the radio stations have been very generous in running our radio ads as PSAs. And, lately we've gotten a couple of high-profile endorsements. Pete Buttigieg endorsed what we're doing, and we did some paid social media behind his endorsement. John Mellencamp endorsed what we're doing. And we have a media kit on our website, onemorevoice.com. Go to onemorevoice.com. And so I've been really, really pleased with what our agency Element 3 has produced for us. And back to what Lou said, I couldn't be more grateful for the hard work that Lou and Ty and his entire team. I mean, they've really gone the extra mile to create opportunities for me to spread the word about what we're doing. So now it's called Earned Media, right? In our day, it was called Free Media. And now I know why. Now for sure, I know why it's called Earned Media. Lou and Ty and his team worked hard to earn that media.
Robert, you've worked on some campaigns. What do you think of this?
Well, I also administered 5 elections from the voters of Marion County in 2003, 2004, and 2006. And, there always was a flurry of people who registered at the last minute. Turnout was always low. I think that the Barack Obama campaign probably did turn out as well as anyone could in 2008. What they did was significant, and which makes the fact that Mitch Daniels carrying Marion County in 2008, winning Marion County while Barack Obama was shattering records as far as winning margin, goes to Lou's point. I used to tell Mayor Ballard, your audience for what you're saying is the person with the Obama sign and the Daniels sign in their front yard. And in Marion County, there were a lot of those. And so to the extent I agree with Lou 100% that party affiliation is important, but it's not as dispositive as it was a generation ago, for sure.
Well, I think, Barack Obama and Mitch Daniels are both great examples that it's candidates who drive turnout. It's not necessarily parties. It's not issues. It's candidates.
Enthusiasm matters. And both of those candidates had it in considerable volume in 2008. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel, Grand Hall, and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. Our guests on the podcast today are Bill Morrow and Lou Gehrig. Our co-host is Jim Shella. It's been a terrific conversation so far. I want to talk just a little bit about your respective careers. Bill and Lou, were you in D.C. at the same time? Did you meet back then? Bill mentioned decades and decades and decades. So can you pinpoint that for us?
Go ahead. Yes, we were there. He was on Birch's staff, and I was on Senator Lugar's staff. So did not know each other well, but I knew who Bill was. And we always had a friendly competition. One time, Mitch, anytime there was a vote, I'm not sure Bill remembers this. I'm sure he will after I tell him. If there was a vote and Lugar voted one way and Birch Bayh voted the other, our chief of staff, Mitch Daniels, always felt that it was proper to send a mailing back to Indiana with Senator Lugar's vote circled and Birch Bayh's vote circled. Now, we were each Senate office is given so many sheets of paper to do these kinds of activities. And one time, and I think probably, I don't know who said, a reporter said, go over there to the check the number of mailings that people send out and see which states are one and two. Well, California was one, and Indiana, Dick Lugar was number two. Now, you're only allotted so many sheets of paper, but we had a wonderful person in our office by the name of Albert Mitchler who traded sheets of paper with other members of the Senate so that we could send out more mailings. But that was, yes, we used to send those mailings out all the time.
Now, we did a podcast. Go ahead, Bill. You finish your
thought. Well, I was just going to say, I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations says run on that audacity that was just admitted to. But I think more importantly is that folks ought to understand that Birch Bayh and Dick Lugar had great respect for each other, became very, very, very close friends. And the tone that they set also extended to the staff. Now, were the staffs competitive? Yes, the staffs were competitive. To Lou's point, did we always want our guy to get out ahead on news and, you know, be the one, right? In fact, during the Carter years, Democrat in the White House, we always got first jump on all of the grants and contracts and that sort of stuff. There was just an acceptance, right? That Birch Bayh's office would get that news out first. But at the staff level, we were very collegially together across the board on many issues. The competition between Birch Bayh and Dick Lugar ended in 1974. When Dick Lugar took office in the Senate in 1977, they started a friendship that lasted the rest of their lives. And, you read about that, and if you weren't a part of it, you'd think, okay, well, it's, you know, somebody's glossing over. No, the two of them went to their graves, sadly, very close together, the closest of friends.
And I should say, we did a Leaders and Legends podcast on the career of Dick Lugar, Senator Lugar, and we also did one on the career of Birch Bayh and how closely they worked together was brought out in those podcasts, which you can find on the All Indiana Podcast Network.com. Lou, how stunned were you, or were you stunned, when Dan Quayle beat Birch Bayh, who was running for his fourth term, beat him in the 1980 election?
Well, I was on the staff then, and with about 3 weeks to go, we got a phone call that that the numbers were fairly close. And so Mitch took a 3-week vacation and went back to help run the campaign. And I think that we were, in 1980, kind of like 2016 was, there just seemed to be something going on that we weren't sensing. But it was with the election of Ronald Reagan, and so we were not surprised, not shocked, but I think we were surprised. But going with 3 weeks to go in the campaign, the Quayle campaign reached out to Mitch and said, "We think we got a shot at this."
Go ahead. And Luger served until 2012, and I worked on a Luger super PAC for that primary in which he lost, and then we subsequently just tossed away a United States Senate seat. So folks, even younger people, say in their 20s and 30s, remember Luger and his impact and his stature for sure. You'd have to be a little bit older to understand what a magnificent Senator Birch Bayh was and what a titan he was in Indiana politics and in the Senate. Bill, did you get a sense that you were working for one of the truly great men in American government?
The easiest question, the answer to that is absolutely yes. I gather my composure even to talk about him now. Next second only to my own father, Birch Bayh had an enormous impact on my life in so many ways, including my marriage and everything that's come from that. I want to back up, though, a second and talk about the 1980 election. I didn't know until this moment that Mitch Daniels came back and took a three-week vacation to work on the Quayle campaign. And I'd be pissed off, but for the fact that I know that Mitch Daniels had absolutely nothing to do with Dan Quayle's victory. And that's not to be churlish. That's just simply to state a historical fact when you look at what happened on election night 1980. My recollection is that 8 incumbent United States, Democratic United States senators lost that night due to the magnitude of the Reagan landslide. Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't want to be snarky, but I was later in a job interview, which I didn't get when you hear the punchline. I was later in a job interview at Ice Miller, Donatio and Ryan, in which Harry Gonzo was interviewing me and reflected that, as it turned out, Republicans could have nominated Daffy Duck, and Daffy Duck would have beaten Birch Bayh that night. And I said, well, I think you did nominate Daffy Duck. And and he said, well, I don't think this interview is going very well. And I agreed with him. That was the only law firm in town I never got a job offer from.
I think we should note that Harry Gonzo was chief of staff for the first few years of the Mitch Daniels time as governor. The other question I want to say, here's what I want to say very quickly to defend Bill. I know he's not a grudge holder, because the last time I saw Bill, I was having lunch at the Working Man's Friend with Mark Miles. And if you listen to the Mark Miles podcast on Leaders and Legends, you will know that Mark was the campaign manager for Dan Quayle for Senate 1980. So Bill does not hold grudges, that's for sure. Another question I wanted to ask real quickly about Mitch Daniels, since it keeps getting brought up, is, Bill, were you at law school with him at the same time? You both went to Georgetown in D.C.
Yeah, well, the answer to that is we overlapped. But I think that Mitch Daniels and I may have set some sort of ignominious record for the few classes that we attended. We were both in the night program, the four-year night program, and believe me, we had more than full-time jobs. I think Mitch had the nickname "the Ghost" at Georgetown. Of course, he didn't need to attend class because he's so doggone smart. I did need to attend class and didn't, and my transcript, which I keep under lock and key, would prove that.
One of the things we like to do in the Leaders and Legends podcast is to talk to folks who were in the room or were involved in amazing events. And pretty soon on the Leaders and Legends podcast, you will listen to our interview with Clint Hill, the Secret Service man who climbed aboard the Kennedy limousine in Dallas in November of 1963. But we have someone on today, Lou Gehrig, along with his friend Bill Morrow. But Lou was in the room for the aftermath of the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan, March 30th, 1981. Lou, I've read a couple of interviews in which you talk about that day. You mentioned earlier that you worked for Jim Brady, who was Reagan's press secretary, who was grievously injured that morning. Please talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about what that day was like, not only from a friend perspective, but as a, you know, PR media guy.
Well, we had become good friends, and normally, and another Hoosier great by the name of Bill Gaither was having a concert that night at Constitution Hall. And so usually when my wife, Beverly, would come in, I would take the bus in, and then I'd meet Jim Brady at Arlington, and we'd come in to the White House in his yellow Jeep. So we rode in together, and we always had breakfast together about at 6:15, 6:30 in the morning, and kind of got our agendas, what we wanted to do. And then his news conference was not his news conference, but he always briefed the press around noon. Well, the irony of this is Mark Blubbers was in that last news conference with him. Mark and Mitch and I and a gentleman by the name of Shaw had gone to the NCAA basketball tournament in Philadelphia on Saturday. And Mark was at Harvard. We drove back. So Mark was there for the last one, and we walked out, and Jim says, well, who's going to go with the president? Now, I never traveled with the president inside the city. I would travel with him on the plane, and I was in the press plane when we would go outside of the state or go outside of Washington, D.C., like if we were going to Notre Dame or Texas or something like that. So there, Bill and Gloria Gaither, I just called over to the president's secretary, and I asked her, I said, when's the president going to be back? And she said, well, it'll be about 40 minutes. So I said, can these people come over and get a tour of the Oval Office? And she said, yes. And my assistant took them over there. Well, it was during that time that we were alerted that there'd been a shooting, that the shots had been fired. And at that point, the irony of all of this is it happened early in the afternoon around 1 or 1:30. At 4 o'clock, we were going to meet with the Secret Service to talk about what do we do if there's a crisis. So in the afternoon, we were going to meet with the Secret Service to talk about what to do during a crisis. And we were in the midst of one right then. And everybody was very professional about what needed to be done. And one of the things we had to try to notify the parents of Jim that their son had been shot. And it was during that time it was reported that Jim had died, which was not the case. And so we went over to the press room and had Larry Speaks he was the deputy press secretary, and he did the discussion and the answers and questions. And it was about that time we left, and here comes Alexander Haig sweating, and he says, I've got to go to the podium. So we stand there and just kind of listen, and he starts announcing that he's in charge. And the irony of it was, is he had been in the Situation Room. And everybody around there looked up, and they had no clue. They thought he had left to go to the restroom. And they said, well, there's an old tape of Alexander Haig. And needless to say, it was not tape. It was real.
From his Nixon years as chief of staff. I was gonna ask you, what were your thoughts when he went up there to do his Dr. Strangelove routine?
You know, he always treated me with respect. But at that time, I thought to myself, he's just sealed his future around here, because that was totally uncalled for. But he felt that Larry Speaks had said something that was going to alert the foreign powers that was not what they needed to hear. But that was not the way the show was supposed to run. So,
did you maintain your long, I mentioned Jim Brady was hurt grievously, yes. As I said, what was it like to maintain your friendship with him and stay in contact?
We stayed in contact. He then moved to Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, which is as Bill knows, is what they call the Washington, D.C. capital, the summer capital. So he had a house there, and we used to go there every year, and we would see him. And I brought him back here once. He came back and spoke to a college. He spoke at Anderson University, spoke to IU Health, and spoke to a group of Boy Scouts. So he came back here. So I'd see him once every 6 months, and he still had a sense of humor. That was a long day. I mean, I didn't leave the White House for 48 hours.
And you mentioned earlier a trip to Philadelphia with Mark Lubbers. Is there a particular reason you went to Philadelphia to watch the NCAA tournament that weekend?
Oh, that's right. The Hoosiers were in it. And we had great seats thanks to the Kentucky senators. They gave us Kentucky didn't make it, so they said, here, you take our seat. So we did. I didn't go back Monday night. I mean, there was no way I could, even under normal circumstances. But so Mark came down, and we took him to the last news conference to Jim Brady.
And Monday night, March 30th, 1981, IU beat North Carolina for the national championship. This is where I should note that Bill Moreau is a proud Boilermaker. And I'm sorry you didn't get to experience any joy that year. It's your turn, Bill.
Well, I must tell you, I won a ton of money by betting on my Boilermakers in 80, right? We had a law school pool. They went to the Final Four that year. And I won $250 just by, you know, having Purdue go all the way, you know, all the way to win the championship. So little did I know that was the high watermark of
And we should note that we had Ray Tolbert, center for the 1981 or forward for the 1981 national championship team of IU on the Leaders and Legends podcast. For the next few minutes, Jim Schell is going to take back over, and then we will finish with the five questions with these two august gentlemen. Jim.
Well, I mean, just listening to you two, Bill and Lou, it's interesting because you've been very involved in politics, but you've also been very involved in government. And what you're talking about mostly is government. I haven't heard very much about campaigns or races. Most people think that it's the politics that's fun, and the government that's drudgery. Is that a misconception?
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, look, there is a group of political, they call themselves professionals, but they're more aptly be characterized as political hacks, who would tell you that government is something that you do between campaigns. That was certainly not the tradition in which Lou and I came of age. You campaigned in order that you could govern, in order that you could try to make a difference in people's lives. I guess I would just observe that for those benighted souls who all they get up every day and worry about winning the next election at any cost, and then leave governing to for those who are there to pick up the pieces. Kind of shame on you. But I'll tell you this, that I've learned a lot in the last couple of years working on this Indiana Citizen project, is that, many, many, many Hoosiers that I've had contact with, those who've come to our cause, Republicans and Democrats, literally, we've got financial supporters from literally across the political spectrum. Each and every one of them wants to make Indiana a better place. And so they view campaigns as just a necessary evil to get us to the next chapter in governing. And having spent much of my life in government, I can tell you that always been very, very impressed by the quality of people who are drawn to government. You know, you think about the demands that are placed upon our public servants, all the scrutiny, all the long hours, and the low pay. And I think Indiana has drawn to its public servants some really, really remarkably talented people, regardless of their party, are really motivated by trying to do the best that they can for the people of the state of Indiana.
Lou, your take.
Well, I think, again, Bill and I both work with two giants. And so every day was an adventure in what are we going to do to change the world or make the state of Indiana better. And I think, too, the when you serve on the early staff, there's a special bond between those people that serve on the early staffs of some of these people. I mean, I listened to your podcast about Eric Holt, and you look at the Congressman Hostetler staff. You look at where those people are now today. You look at where the people were that served with Birch Bayh in those early years. You look where Senator Lugar, where they are. I think politics, yes, it was important to get reelected or get elected, but there also was a lot of excitement working with the staff, working for a boss like Senator Lugar or Senator Bayh.
We've touched on this in our discussion, but you know the real story in American politics at the moment is divisiveness, and the recent death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and all the discussion that took place immediately thereafter probably is a good example. There are many others. Can it be repaired? You folks got started at a time. You talked about how Republicans and Democrats got along and worked together. There's not a lot of that right now. Will it come back?
Well, look, I think that redistricting, gerrymandering, the necessity of just party fealty in order to get through the next party primary, has certainly played a role. I don't know how to put the reaction to Justice Ginsburg's death into some perspective, except to say that it was just a few years ago that Justice Scalia died, and we remember the debate that touched off. You'd hope that maybe in the moment there'd be a civics lesson about the role of the president and the Senate in the selection of a Supreme Court justice. But Jim, I don't see a return to the politics that Lou and I grew up in. I don't see that anytime soon. I will say, at the risk of sounding like I'm reverting back to my partisan tendencies, a change in the White House, I think I'll have a change. There will be a change in the tone emanating from that building, to be sure. What that does to the quality of discussion throughout the rest of the country, I guess, will remain to be seen. But I don't see this hyper-partisanship going away any time soon. If politicians don't fear the general election, that is to say, if they're not concerned about putting together a coalition to get to 50.1% in the general election, if all they care about is getting through their party primary, what's the point? Right?
Just, and that's a result of gerrymandering. Yeah. Lou?
Well, I'm an optimist. And I think that we've hit on kind of a tone, and that is the quality of the candidates moving forward. I'm not going to reflect on the two candidates for president now, because I think what has happened is the system has been overtaken by outside influences and not the political parties. We've got more money coming in not from Republican or Democrat sources, are coming from outside sources, and they're spending a lot of money. And so I think, again, you go back to Evan Bayh. The Democrats, when Evan Bayh was running for governor, were struggling. And all of a sudden, they came up with this fresh, young, talented face, and he made the difference. And Mitch Daniels was a different person. And so I think you've got to find the quality of the candidates. at all levels. But the problem is the quality that we would like to see, they don't want to run because they don't want to put their families through the experience that they have to go through and the things they have to say to get elected. And so, like I said, I want to be an optimist, but I'm a realist right now.
Let me ask a quick question before we get to the five questions. Lou, I'll go to you first, and then I'll go to Bill. Lou, you worked for Senator Lugar.
Right.
Mitch Daniels was chief of staff, then became governor. How much were Richard Lugar and Mitch Daniels alike? And what do you think Mitch learned from his boss, Senator Lugar? And then, Bill, I'm going to ask you about Birch and Evan Bayh next. Lou?
Well, there's no doubt that Senator Lugar was, and again, I'm going to, Senator Bayh was a class act also, but for Senator Lugar, was to look at an issue and come up with a way that it would solve a major problem. He was the only one of the few Republicans that supported the bailout for New York City. But what he did is he put a caveat in there that the unions, if New York City defaulted, then the unions in New York City, they had to pay the money and not the federal government. So everybody had skin in the game. What Mitch learned, I think Mitch, of course, is one of the smartest guys I've ever known. And I think what Mitch learned from Lugar was trying to serve all the people, not just one segment, but to try to serve all of them. You know, Mitch, both of them, retail politics was not necessarily Dick Lugar's strength. Phil Jones of CBS News, who was from Fairmount, Indiana, and was very good friends of ours, used to say, when you ask Dick Lugar what time is, he'll tell you how to make the watch. And Mitch, when he started out, was not retail politics was not he had run campaigns. And Jim, you saw this. I mean, he transformed himself into doing something he really enjoys and doing well at, and that is getting out and meeting the people. And he does that now at Purdue. So I think they both had the same, once they were both very, very smart, very hardworking, and they were looking for solutions outside the box.
Bill, you worked for both Birch Bayh in the Senate and was chief of staff to his son, Evan Bayh, not only Secretary of State, but in the governor's office. How would you compare those two men?
Well, we are all the product of two parents. So your question goes to Evan's similarities, I guess, with his father, and they were many. Of course, they were raised differently, for sure. You know the biography of Birch Bayh, how he was raised, and his last years in high school on the farm and growing prize tomato crops. And then Evan, of course, who moved with his parents to Washington, D.C. at the age of 7 and spent his formative years in Washington, D.C. But fundamentally, they were very similar in terms of their core values, in terms of their dedication to public service, the idea that we ought to get up every day trying to figure out how to make Indiana a better place. They were identical. And I got to tell you that if you read Evan's book about his father, right, he wrote a book really dedicated to the lessons that he learned from his father. And if you'd had the sad experience that I had of working with Evan on his father's memorial service, you'd have an understanding of just how much Evan revered his father. And he, you know, in a sense, you know, to all of us, Birch Bayh was a little larger than life, you know, even though we knew him so well, because of just the amount of energy he brought every day to politics and government, and his core value is sensitivity, particularly the needs of working people and those less fortunate. So I like to say that Evan got the best of both parents.
Well, I should mention here before we go to the five questions that Birch Bayh was worshipped in my household when I was a kid, and I remember vividly my mother crying when Marvella Bayh, Evan's mother, died at a very, very young age. It's time for the five questions. We end every podcast with the same five, and we will go in, oh, let's go in alphabetical order. So, Lou, you're going to be up first on all these questions. Shella, we've already asked you these five questions, but you feel free to shame or chime in based on their answers. First question, Lou, what was your first job?
Well, you mean out of college or before?
Before. First job where you made your own money.
My parents decided, because I like to get up at 4:30 in the morning, that I start passing papers. So I passed the Anderson Herald paper at 4:30 in the morning.
About what year was that?
Oh, let's see. That was probably 1957. I was 12.
Bill?
My first job was delivering the Leavenworth Times in Leavenworth, Kansas, at the age of 13.
Inside or outside the prison?
Well, as you know, Robert, there's Fort Leavenworth, which is the home of the Command and General Staff College, which is mm-hmm. where my dad was at the time.
I should notice that there are several journalists on this podcast. Lou worked at a newspaper. Bill did. Obviously, Jim was the dean of the White House, of the State House reporters. Chris Spangle has a podcast, We Are Libertarians. I think that qualifies him. And I was a broadcast journalist in the Army. Question number two, Lou, what was your first concert?
Well, it probably was the Beach Boys in the 60s. Down at downtown Indianapolis at the State Fair.
Bill?
Well, first concert being, you know, not a band concert or you know, because if you grow up on an Army post, as I did, you were subjected to a lot of John Philip Sousa marches. Those probably don't count as my first concert, but I have a rather vague recollection of my first Grateful Dead concert in the fall of 1970.
Yeah, how many followed?
A few.
How many Grateful Dead concerts have you been to?
Six. I certainly wouldn't characterize myself as a deadhead because I had to grow up too quickly and graduate and go to work and get on with life.
Number three, Lou, if you could suggest any book for someone to read, which book would you choose?
I'll tell you the book. It's the book about Truman.
The David McCullough book?
David McCullough book. That and anything on LBJ. I'm a real LBJ follower because I give credit, and there were several people, but LBJ was the key in getting civil rights legislation passed because only a Southern Democrat president could have gotten that done. And so those would be two. If you're interested in politics, 5 days in Philadelphia about Wendell Willkie. You know, those would be three.
Bill?
I'm going to surprise you. I'll probably be your only guest that would ever mention this book. But particularly for those of us who've spent any time inside politics and government, it's a little known book called Shut Up, Show Up, and Come Back When You F Up by Carville and Bagala. Honest to goodness, when it first came out, I bought 100 of those to send them out to clients and friends so that they would have some appreciation for the lessons that can be learned if you spend some time inside politics and government. It's a great overlooked book, easy read, great, great lessons, especially for those of us who spend some time in politics and government.
Number four, Lou, if you could witness any event in history, be there in person as it happens, which event would you choose?
You mean if I could participate also in that event?
You could participate. You could stand on the sidelines. Up to you.
Well, I think it would be me teeing off on the first hole of the Masters in second place.
Now, that's a unique answer, Bill.
I'd like to be present for the Gettysburg Address.
Number five, Lou, if you could have dinner with anyone living today, 2 hours completely off the record, whom would you choose?
Winston Churchill.
Living today.
Living, pal.
Oh, oh, living. Well, other than Bill Moreau.
Hey, Jim Shell is sitting right there.
Jim Shell. Yeah. There are so many.
I struggled with this one too, Lou.
Yeah.
This is why you don't get the questions ahead of time, because we like the struggle.
Probably one of the most significant days of my life was seeing the Iran hostages come back. And I was on the street at Constitution Avenue with Phil Jones. Probably would be one of them, one of the surviving members of the Iranian hostages.
A terrific answer. Terrific. Bill?
Well, up until a few days ago, I would have said, and I was prepared to say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I can't say that. I would have to say Barack Hussein Obama. If spend a couple of hours with him completely off the record, get a chance to talk about his life and all that he's learned along the way. I really do think, setting aside partisanship, if we can for a moment, he has been such a consequential figure in world history. That is indisputable, I think.
One of the things we try to do on the Leaders and Legends podcast, and we do it often with the help of the wonderful Jim Shella, is to bring Republicans and Democrats together who are friends, who have worked together, who have maybe fussed a bit at each other and the political world, but have worked together in terms of government for the betterment of our city and state. We had Ed Tracy and Jim Kittle on, Paul Okeson and Mike O'Connor. Ed Tracy required a little bit of a delay in the recording because there was some editing that needed to be done, but we love him regardless. And we had Louis Mayhern and John Mutz, and we hope to have some others. And it's important for us to have folks on who get along, because this civilization and this society doesn't advance without it. I should mention, we had Robin Winston and Mike McDaniel on for a rollicking conversation. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel, Grand Hall, and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. Our guests on the Leaders and Legends podcast have been Bill Morrow and Lou Gehrig, longtime friends. We have been joined by co-host Jim Shella, and I'll say the same thing about all three of these men. If you look up the words respect, genuine, and kind, you will find no better example. Thank you all for coming on the podcast today. Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.